Hello, I'm Peter Goodwin with your latest podcast. We're looking at just some of the exciting papers in the spring edition of Paediatric Physical Therapy. Coming up, we'll hear about intensive physical therapy for a child with a left ventricular assist device attached, about therapy for cerebral palsy during an adolescent growth spurt, gait deficiencies, and exercise for babies with spina bifida. And with me on the line from Los Angeles is our editor, Linda Fettes, from the University of Southern California. In case anyone doesn't know, you are, of course, Linda, the new editor-in-chief of Paediatric Physical Therapy. So how's the job going so far?
Well, it's what I describe as an enjoyable challenge. I think it's going well. Anne Van Sant, our editor from the past 21 years, has been a wonderful mentor and has, I hope, brought me up to speed in the challenging task. So I'm enjoying it.
And what sort of differences are you making? I mean, is it new broom sweeps in a different way, at least? So what are you doing?
Well, we have a new editorial group. In addition to editor-in-chief and editor emeritus, who is Anne Van Sant, we have a group of six associate editors for the first time. And I'm hoping that they will bring in new ideas. They'll certainly share the workload with me, which is wonderful. And I'm looking forward to a new structure and some new energy.
Right. And from the upcoming edition, the spring edition, are there themes or ideas that you'd like to just mention to us at the start?
The biggest theme that I see in reviewing the papers and the cases that have been that are a part of this new issue is the diversity of research and clinical practice in pediatric physical therapy. I think that the readers will see the various topics will certainly touch many people's clinical practice and research efforts. And I think it's really a hallmark of us as a group of pediatric researchers and clinicians that we are very diverse.
Thanks, Linda. So we'll start with how you can give therapy in difficult clinical situations. Some children who could benefit from intensive physical therapy may well be having treatments that could make this difficult or hazardous. At the Boston Children's Hospital, Kelly Lombard needed to give therapy to a child who'd had a stroke, was in heart failure, and had an external left ventricular assist device connected to him while he was waiting for a heart transplant.
This was a 10-year-old boy who had hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. He was diagnosed at a young age, and he was admitted to the hospital with an upper respiratory tract infection, and he ended up having a stroke. They found he was in heart failure, and so he was implanted with a left ventricular assist device. And after spending some time in the acute care hospital, he was transferred to inpatient rehab, where he came to us, and we had never had a patient with an LVAD before. It's new with these new devices. They're smaller, they're portable, so the patients can actually be discharged from the acute care hospital.
You had a machine external to the boy then?
Yes, so there's a drive line that comes out of his abdomen, and then there's a small pack that has the controller for the device and a battery pack as well. So we did not mess with the controller at all. That's for the physicians to make changes to the device, but he did have to carry it with him at all times, and it had to stay close to his body because if, you know, it pulled away, you risk dislodging the device in an emergency situation, which we did not want.
And how much did the LVAD limit his activities then?
So at first he had had a stroke, so he had a hemiparetic posture, and he had a hard time just carrying the device. It was about 2.5 pounds, and there's a strap that goes around his shoulder, which was not intended for use in pediatrics. The device was originally intended for adults, so the pack was not really meant for a smaller size, and so he had to carry this around. Initially, he wasn't able to carry it on his own because he was weak. He had poor endurance, so he would fatigue very quickly. So we had to carry it for him. And then with his therapy, we focused a lot on increasing his independence with it so that he was able to carry it with him at all times.
Right. Now, I gather that you've been using intense physical therapy. What exactly did you do?
So for his physical therapy, we saw him twice a day for about 30 to 45 minutes for each session. And we focused a lot on strengthening. So just, you know, basic therapeutic exercise, lots of functional strengthening in different positions. We worked a lot on his balance, both static and dynamic balance in sitting and standing, and a lot of focus on his independence with mobility and his endurance. So we did a lot of work on the treadmill. He was a bit self-limiting because of his, you know, history with this cardiac diagnosis. So the treadmill gave us a good opportunity to be able to increase his speed and increase the amount of time that he was walking, which wasn't really possible when he was self-selecting his own walking speed.
And what happened then?
After, you know, 6 weeks, or sorry, 4 weeks at inpatient rehab, he was discharged home. And we did receive word that he did actually have a heart transplant and is doing well now. So very happy news for us.
Happy news for you, ultimately. How much response did he make to the rehabilitation physical therapy that you undertook?
Oh, he did great. He made improvements in all of his impairments. By the time he left, he was independent with most mobility, just requiring some supervision for his ambulation, stairs, and also getting on and off the floor. But everything else he was independent with. He was carrying the device on his own. We did a lot of education with parents on, you know, promoting independence and when to give him rest breaks so that he could do everything on his own. He was able to return to school. So he did fantastic in terms of his outcomes. With the LVAD, you know, performing the function of his heart, we really, really were trying to promote that independence and give him some more confidence in what he was able to do.
And what were the tricks that you used to get that confidence lift?
So we did a lot of, you know, trying to incorporate our interventions into play so that he was having fun and a bit more distracted. We did a lot of, you know, activities where he was painting, he was riding an adaptive bicycle, lots of, you know, different playing around things to make him have a good time. And then we also focused a lot on coaching him through deep breathing and encouraging him and, you know, trying to reinforce that he was okay and his body was okay and that, you know, he could push himself a bit more. And he seemed to respond quite well to that.
Kelly Lombard from the Physical and Occupational Therapy Department of the Boston Children's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, the consequences of giving therapy to an adolescent with cerebral palsy during a growth spurt, are the benefits more or less during an accelerated growth phase? And what are the practical issues? These questions have been addressed in a 10-week study of a 13-year-old boy by Rebecca Rubens in Tampa. And I asked her first, what were the big issues she was trying to investigate?
Well, first and most importantly, motivating an adolescent 13-year-old boy to actually get through a growth spurt. Growth spurts, the accelerated growth period, actually causes these kids, even kids that don't have motor impairments, to be kind of clumsy, to kind of lose their balance, not be coordinated as they're growing. And so it's so important, especially with a child with CP, to restore and improve their function, range of motion, their strength during this time of growth.
And what data do we have that physical therapy helps with all of this at this growth spurt period?
So it's really important with the children with cerebral palsy, motion. Motion is imperative for the visual and the vestibular system to learn. So with the combination of doing hippotherapy, which is what we did, and a little bit of home therapy as well, this combination actually helped increase the strength with the use of what they call a compressor belt, which actually increased his strength as he was learning some different coordination and balance. There's muscle groups around the pelvis that we need to strengthen, and what the belt did was help strengthen those agonist, antagonistic muscle groups so that he could actually get himself upright again.
Right. Now, can you give me a little bit more detail about what you did to achieve all of this? You had a 10-week program, didn't you?
Absolutely. So the intention of using these different interventions with the hippotherapy and the home therapy was to actually strengthen these muscle groups. So when you were on the horse, what we did was the type of this prolonged stretching with the weighted compressor belt, with the rhythmical movement of the horse, allowed, you know, myself to be able to overcome these stretch reflexes that these children get. They kind of want to recoil, and what we want to do is lengthen those muscle spindles so that they can get those long, soft tissue abilities so that they can get up and walk again and be able to move. So this was one of the big important things to be able to do. And then in the home, we actually carried that range of motion and strength that he got into task strength training in the functional, you know, in functional motion. So when he was going, he has stairs in his home. He has two flights of stairs. So he would actually go up and down the stairs with this compressor belt on and actually carry over that increased range of motion that he got from hippotherapy.
Now, obviously, it's difficult to know how well he would have done without the physical therapy. So how much of an impact do you think your program had?
Well, I think that at this point, having something like this, I think there were actually some key findings that we found out when we were actually working with this little boy. Number one, motivation, even though it's very hard to define, you know, what it is, what actually, you know, where does it come from? I think that we as physical therapists, the key finding that we need to understand is that if we can get the patient to do anything to help himself, then we've tapped into bringing out what that patient's motivation is. I think it's really important for us to understand that, you know, especially with children of this age, it's so important because at that point they're so concerned about dealing with the kids that are around them in school and in, you know, different environments in their home and so forth. They have a lot of stresses coming in on them on that level. So we have to find something that's going to motivate them to want to get well.
So what would you say are the messages for physiotherapist coming out of this at the moment?
Well, there's some key findings that we found, and one of the key findings was, of course, is that, you know, there was actually an energy efficiency that we found that actually agreed with Damiano, one of his research articles, that if you actually get these muscles around the pelvis that we were just discussing before, those agonist-antagonistic muscles, these, you know, these muscle groups in children, that you actually increase more energy efficiency. And then we also found that it's very, very important during this time frame of growth spurts that you were very, very careful, especially between some of the testing that we had done, between the time up and down the stairs and the one-minute walk test, that you have to be very careful during this time with children with growth spurts that they won't fall into the suggested gross motor function level that you actually were classifying them in. And that, what's so important about that is that therapists need to use all the information before classifying them in these different levels. And I would say that the most important thing, that the take-home for this case report, it demonstrated that, you know, physical impairment is quite different than disability, and that a growth spurt is a critical period for physical therapy intervention. So the physical therapist's unique understanding of these tight spastic muscles, actually, you know, what we can do as therapists to create an engaging program that motivates and encourages the adolescent during this time can actually help these children avoid contractures, and that they'll be able to go ahead, you know, and avoid the possibility of future surgeries. And that's really, I think, the take-home message right there.
Rebecca Rubens from the University of South Florida in Tampa. Well, if you're studying the effectiveness of your therapy in a child with cerebral palsy, you need to define the parameters very clearly. In the spring edition of Pediatric Physical Therapy, Mary Giannotti's published an analysis that found that although consumer satisfaction, participation, and quality of life were the most important outcomes to measure, these were the least likely to be documented. I asked her first how they went about conducting their study.
The first thing is when you talk about treatment effectiveness, you need to have a grasp about what is an effective treatment. So the first thing that we needed to determine was among a group of experts, and these would be clinicians and researchers and managers of large pediatric hospitals, what were important outcomes? And so we identified outcomes across the ICF model, and those outcomes included quality of life, and they included activity, measures of activity, consumer satisfaction, participation in society, and pain.
And what did you find in the study?
Well, we found that there are a plethora of measures that look at all of these different outcomes, as well as child characteristics such as level of severity and comorbidities, as well as important aspects of family functioning like social support and family values, and that we needed to work hard looking at available evidence and what measures would be feasible to use in the clinic and what measures were already being used in the clinic.
In day-to-day management then, what were the big things that came out of this?
Well, the things that came out of this were that there were a lot of things that therapists were already doing in the hospital that we could capitalize upon. And there were some things that therapists were not doing, such as evaluating consumer satisfaction or quality of life. So there's some area for knowledge translation. But the most important thing that we're interested in, which is what is happening in the actual therapy session, there is no way that people are consistently and systematically documenting it.
Right, that's a big thing, isn't it? Now, in looking at cerebral palsy then, what are the main messages you'd like to give to clinicians?
I think that the major message is, in fact, that therapists need to think about having common measures in terms of outcomes that not only look at body structures and function, but also, and by that I mean things like pain, but also look at important aspects of the child's life, such as quality of life and participation, but that there's more work to be done. Before we can embark on a study of comparative effectiveness research, we need to develop a form that carefully documents what happens in the physical therapy session. And this needs to be a form that is developed with physical therapists across many centers. We need to build consensus on it, and we need to pilot test it. So I would say that cerebral palsy research is in the stage of infancy in terms of comparative effectiveness research. Although electronic medical records hold promise for helping us understand which treatments might be most effective in promoting health and wellness and quality of life and the other outcomes that we deemed were important, we need to do more work before we can really identify best practice.
It sounds a bit daunting. Do you have any messages of hope for individual physical therapists? Hints, perhaps, at what simple things they might think about doing first?
Well, I think that physical therapists can be systematic in the way that they document a child's level of severity. They can be systematic and document pain, participation, and quality of life. So I think that the results of this Delphi study point to some measures that are useful for clinicians to use. And it also provides them with measures that have been found to be useful both clinically and useful in research.
Mary Giannotti from the University of Hartford's Department of Rehabilitation Sciences in West Hartford, Connecticut. So, Linda, over to you now. Those three studies, what did you make first of all about the importance of this question of documenting physical therapy, Mary Giannotti's paper there?
Yeah, I think Mary is highlighting a really critical part of our clinical practice, and that is to write down, to document what you've done, but also the specifics of what measurements you used. And we're seeing that as we're trying to aggregate across studies and across cases to understand best practice, that if, in fact, even if it's in a medical record, if there isn't good, accurate documentation, It doesn't allow us to combine research and to combine cases for an understanding of really what is best practice. So I think her point of daily documentation is important, but also looking to the future of having a consensus about certain types of outcome measures that we want to share across the profession is critical. I look forward to Mary being a part of that endeavor.
Now, we often hear about the importance of dose and intensive physical therapy, but what about if you have a child with an external device that really makes it difficult? What did you think of the LVAD news?
Well, Kelly Lombard, I think, is demonstrating the competence, flexibility of physical therapists in meeting new challenges that she certainly hadn't seen before, and in problem solving, how to work around some of the complex cases that present themselves with today's technology and today's, I think, new clinical procedures. So I found her documentation of that case really quite extraordinary and exemplary of sort of creative, challenging new practice.
And what did you pull out of the story on growth spurts? Is it more difficult, and what are the big principles, the guiding principles that you found from Rebecca's story there?
Sure. I think Rebecca's highlighting the importance of viewing the work we do as physical therapists with individuals as lifelong. With cerebral palsy, early on in physical therapy practice, we concentrated on infants and young children, and we recognized that cerebral palsy is a lifetime set of challenges, and that physical therapy needs to work with people with cerebral palsy over the course of their lifetime to try to improve the quality of their life. Certainly during an adolescent growth spurt, this presents new challenges. But I think what Rebecca's really highlighting is that physical therapy needs to be present and available to individuals across the lifespan.
Right. And it's not qualitatively different in the way you give it if it's a growth spurt, is it?
Well, it might be. I don't think we know the answer to that yet. I think adolescence presents a different time period, and different adolescents go through different periods of growth, some rapid, some more gradual. How that interacts with the particular challenges they have and the type of therapy, I think we don't quite know this as fully as we will in the future.
Thanks, Linda. Well, cancer therapy for children is one of the biggest success stories in medicine, but those who are cured with the help of agents like vincristine often get chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, and this can lead to gait disorders. Laura Gilchrist has been analysing what are the important factors for the physical therapist to monitor when treating gait deficits.
Well, we had noticed that children, after they receive vincristine, they walk differently, and they complain to their parents about tripping and that things just don't feel quite the same. And so we started looking at what were those differences and if we could tease out those differences doing some kind of gait analysis. And we really looked to see, are they walking slower? Are they walking with a wider base of support? Lots of those kinds of things. And the answer is yes, they actually do walk much slower with a wider base of support and a much shorter step length.
Right.
Although, yeah, and we found that their cadence wasn't different.
Right. So basically, these are all things that the physical therapist could get involved with. So what did you do in the study to examine these different parameters?
So we used a gait right analysis system. So we call it with the kids a magic carpet that they walk on, and it picks up their footsteps and automatically measures their step length, their base of support, and all of those kinds of things. But I think most interestingly, we knew that kids they complained of having problems walking when they were out shopping, when they were out in the community, when they were at school. And so we tried to do a fatiguing task with them to bring out some of these differences that they noticed that you might not just see if you saw them walking across the room. So we made them do a 6-minute walk test, and we looked at the results before and after the 6-minute walk test.
And what were the numbers coming out of this then?
So we found, I think the biggest thing that we found after the 6-minute walk test was that we anticipated that they would get fatigue in their foot musculature and in their lower leg musculature because of the neuropathy they have. And that's exactly what we saw, is that they're not using their foot in the same way. They get foot flap. They don't use a dynamic foot. So they really walk flat-footed, basically, but only after they have walked for a while.
Now, you had quite a big group, too, because you looked at 52 kids. Where does the physical therapist come into this, and what have you gleaned that could be useful for physical therapists?
Absolutely. So, yeah, we did look at a fairly big group. We studied this group over a period of time to get enough subjects here. And, you know, one of the things that we saw is, okay, so what can we do about this? And strengthening is certainly something that we can do to change that dynamic of the foot, but it's also balance and ankle range of motion. And those are all things that physical therapists can intervene with, so that we saw that the unique contributions to these changes in their gait pattern really had to do with how bad is their balance, and that's something we can work on, and how limited is their ankle range of motion. And so those are things that we can key in on and say, okay, if I can change that, then I can probably change this gait pattern.
So how would you summarize the take-home message then for clinicians coming out of your research?
Oh, well, number one, I would say there are changes. Just because a kid can get up and walk across the room and look okay doesn't mean that that's how they function all the time. That's what the 6-minute walk told us. And secondly, if you do see something that is off in their gait, that is a kid who needs to come to physical therapy. And in so many different practices, we don't see that they get to physical therapy.
Laura Gilchrist from St. Catherine's University and the Pediatric Blood and Cancer Disorder Clinic at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And if you have a child with a gait abnormality of whatever origin, the practice of routinely calling in the orthopaedic surgeon for a diagnosis is questioned in a study published in the journal by Stacey Miller from Vancouver. Her group's been looking at the level of concordance between physical therapist and orthopaedic surgeon diagnosis. I asked her what they did in the study.
We compared the decision-making of a physiotherapist and an orthopedic surgeon for children that were referred to the orthopedic surgeon for what we kind of termed typical variations of normal gait.
How did you go about this?
So we had 25 children enrolled in the study, and the physiotherapist went in and saw the child and completed a form that was created and identified what they felt was the cause of the gait abnormality, as well as what their treatment recommendations would be and their follow-up recommendations. And then they left the room, and then the surgeon went in and did the exact same thing. And we then compared afterwards what our results were.
This sounds like a really clean study. What did you find?
Well, we found that the physiotherapist and the orthopedic surgeon had substantial or almost perfect agreement for both diagnosis, treatment, and follow-up for the children that we saw.
So what's a practical message for everyday use by physiotherapists right now then? What would you say to them? Presumably they can actually make a big benefit to treatment by getting in early and recognizing things quickly.
Yeah, I think it's certainly something for people to be looking at as far as when you're making a referral. Perhaps it can be referred to a physiotherapist rather than to an orthopedic surgeon, as long as the physiotherapist has some background and training in pediatrics and is, you know, used to seeing typical and atypical gait patterns, then they certainly are potentially capable of picking up those gait abnormalities rather than it being done by an orthopedic surgeon.
Stacey Miller from the British Columbia Children's Hospital in Vancouver, Canada. Bone mineral content can be improved by physical therapy in children with spina bifida, according to findings from New York. Lead author Do Kyung Lee gave me the details from her study with 36 infants aged between 1 and 18 months.
About 10 babies received exercise daily, parents-oriented treadmill practice. When they're right after born, like 2 months, 2 weeks, or there's some babies start later, they start at 3 months. And then they received, once they start exercise, they received for 12 months. So it's about a year of the exercise. So parents give them the treadmill practice at their homes. They don't need to come to the clinics to get the exercise. 10 minutes a day, that's a requirement, and 5 days a week, and 7 days without a break.
And how did you compare that then to find out what difference it made?
Then we had a control group who didn't get the exercise, some of the reason, because it is a really, you know, intense, you know, exercise protocol, because they have to commit, you know, commit for the 1 year exercise. And then we compare the bone mineral contents with spinal bifida with the exercise, and then compare with the healthy babies as well.
And did you find an impact of the exercise?
Yes. So really, striking part of this study is that the 10 minutes exercise is not that much, you know, as you're thinking about the life. But even though 10 minutes exercise, the parent fully give their support from their trunk, they do get better. Like they are showing the similar trajectory the healthy baby does, but the content is way lower than the healthy baby, but they are improving. However, compared to the spinal bifida without the exercise group, they don't show any improvement, which means the increase of the bone mineral density. So when they don't get the exercise, their bone mineral contents won't change it.
Right. So what is the clinical message coming out of this then?
Oh, so this actually telling the audience that we need to start the exercise as soon as possible, and that you don't know where we get the impact. And the, one of the strong impact we are getting in here is their bone is getting stronger. So not only their functional outcome will be changed because of having the exercise for a year, but their the underlying mechanism also changed, which is one of the examples of bone mineral contents is changing too.
Do Kyung Lee from the Department of Psychology at New York University, New York City. Well, Linda, I wonder what you make of all of those. We were hearing about, for instance, chemotherapy-induced neuropathy and its impact on gait abnormalities and what you should be measuring. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I think what Laura's describing has been described by clinicians and a few researchers. And that's the importance of following children who've had chemotherapy when they return to a typical daily life, and the importance of seeing what are the challenges post-chemotherapy, because there are clear challenges for many children who've had chemotherapy, and physical therapy can act there to be preventive of future problems. In a similar way, and I'm going to segue a little bit into I think Stacy's paper looking at physical therapy and orthopedic surgeons, because there's, I think, another example of how therapists need to work at educating the medical community as to the role that physical therapists can play, both with the patient who's post-chemotherapy and also as an alternative to recommending an orthopedic surgeon visit, which might be costlier, maybe not be as effective for particular problems, and that these two situations really require therapists to be proactive in educating the other medical health professionals, but also the community in terms of the role physical therapy can play.
And there seems to be some interesting evidence about physical therapy and bone mineral density, and it is in quite small babies giving them exercise. What did you make of that?
Yes, I think that's an important point, Peter, is this quite small babies, that we certainly have seen at the other end of the age spectrum that weight-bearing weights in general, resistance exercise is important for preventing osteoporosis and also for treating osteoporosis in elderly women. Here we're seeing this really wonderful study looking at the prevention of bone mineral loss during infancy, in the first 18 months of life, and how a relatively small effort, as pointed out by the researchers, can yield very positive gains in terms of retaining bone mineral.
Thanks, Linda, very much for all of that. And that is all for this edition of Pediatric Physical Therapy Podcast. We've had, of course, Linda Fetters in Los Angeles. And from Linda and also from me, Peter Goodwin, in the podcast studio, it's goodbye for now and see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye, Peter. Thank you.